Welcome to the Level Playing Field podcast with your host, David Yu, a platform where aviation and finances meet. Each week, David will be interviewing guests from all different careers in aviation who can help us explore how each career impacts a family's personal finances and lifestyle. Now, here's your host, David Yu.
Welcome, I'm David Yu, Certified Financial Planner Practitioner and host of the Level Playing Field podcast. This week I interviewed Denise Jennings. Join me as she talks about her experiences working in various aviation-related companies. She also talks about her experiences as an owner of a Mooney 201, as the former chairwoman of the 99's Fullerton chapter, and now as part of the board of directors at the Aero Club of Southern California. To find out more about my aviation-related podcast and blog, please check out www.thelevelplainfield.com. That's the level, P-L-A-N-E, field.com. If you have any financial questions, consult your attorney, accountant, or financial advisor. If you're interested in how I help airline pilots as a certified financial planner practitioner, please visit www.pacunited.com. That's P-A-C-United.com. All right. So on this episode of Level Playing Field, I'm sitting over here with Denise Jennings. Denise Jennings, she's the business development manager at Pacman, Inc. Pacman creates custom precision scale models, display, and specialty items for the aviation industry. And pretty much work with all the manufacturers, all the airlines, pretty much all across the aerospace or all across the aviation industry and aerospace industry. She's always had a strong passion for aviation. She's an instrument-rated commercial pilot, owns a Mooney 201, which she uses for philanthropical purposes. She was the former chairwoman of the 99's Fullerton chapter and now serves on the board of directors of the Aero Club of Southern California. So welcome to the Level Playing Field podcast, Denise.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I'm glad to have you on over here. So to just kind of start it all off, just tell us, who exactly is Denise Jennings and how did you get into aviation?
Oh, okay. Well, let's go back about 30 years. First of all, let me just say that I think there is something always been in my DNA that my dad was a pilot in World War II. He flew the B-24 Liberator, which is the PB4Y. Okay. And he flew in the South Pacific during World War II. So, and although I never really flew with him because after the war, he did not fly. I think it just kind of something in the DNA or the heredity came through.
So he didn't fly at all.
He passed away when I was 21. And so he never knew that I flew, but I always thought he was shining down and watching and those kinds of things. But anyway, so I was working for TRW at the time. I had been working there for about 17 years. I was working on a new project and we had a legal department and the legal department was doing the contracts. And there was a gal that worked in the legal part of TRW that was made a comment about wanting to learn to fly. And I thought, oh man, that really sounds fun. So we decided that we were going to go and take an introductory lesson. It wouldn't be fun to kind of go through this all together and yada, yada. Well, that year, things changed at TRW and the legal department got all mixed up and she ended up leaving TRW and went to QLogic. So we lost track of each other. I went ahead and went to my introductory lesson and I was completely hooked. I mean, I could not believe how passionate I became about flying. I was at the airport two nights a week for ground school. I was flying two nights a week. My family didn't see me for about 6 months. It was kind of one of those.
What age were you at that point in time? So like when you finally took your first lesson or first flight, I guess.
Well, it was 1990. So that would have been 38 years old.
38? Okay. Okay. So did you...
I was no spring chicken.
Now, did you know that you had a passion for aviation prior to this? Or was it just, hey, like, I might as well, you know, I should probably check this out. And then you fell in love with it.
You know, it was funny. I traveled at my job. And I remember I'd get to the airport and I'd just sit and watch airplanes. I mean, I'd go early so I could sit and watch them. My dad would take us to air shows when we were kids. We lived in Ohio and we went to Akron and we went to air shows and things. So I think that there was always a little twinge of it, but I didn't think about me doing it. I really didn't think about that until I met that gal at work. So we went our separate ways. I started taking my lessons. Like I said, I was kind of immersed into it. And by August of that year, I had my license. Then it was now what do I do? I didn't think that if I rented an airplane, because I really never learned to fly because I just wanted to go get the $50 hamburger. I really wanted to go places. I wanted to go away, go lots of different places. And so renting did not appeal to me. So I started looking for an airplane. And by February of the next year, I'd bought a Cardinal.
And oh, wow. Okay.
1974 Cardinal.
Yeah. So going into your private then, you know, were you thinking about just going instrument? Like, were you just thinking about like just the entire like mission, like what you're going to do with it and purchase a plane and all that kind of stuff? Or did you just kind of go into it and then it just kind of evolved from there?
Well, I knew I wanted my instrument because we live in Southern California and the marine layer can keep us grounded a great deal. So I knew I wanted that. So as soon as I bought the airplane, I started the instrument training in the Cardinal.
Okay.
And I got that done. And then I actually started thinking, I think I want something a little bit faster. And I want to get flying to Oregon a lot to see my sister and see my mother on my vacations and things.
Okay.
And so I researched an airplane that would get me to Bandon, Oregon, which is about 649 nautical miles. It's about 900.
That's a good distance.
Yes. And I needed a fuel stop in the Cardinal, but I wanted something that would get me there without that. So because that takes a long time, you know, that makes it a long time out of your day. I mean, it's silly the things you think about, you know, every time you made a trip, you start to think, how do I make that trip just a little bit faster next time?
Exactly.
Yeah. I want to go faster. So then I started researching and the Mooney came up as the best and most economical cross-country kind of airplane. Very cost effective and good on fuel, very fuel friendly. So I bought a Mooney in 1994 and I've owned that ever since. Yeah, I sold the Cardinal.
How much did you buy it for, if you don't mind me asking?
You know, I'm trying to think. I think it was about 63. Somewhere in there. I don't even remember. It's that long ago.
Yeah.
I think I bought the Cardinal was like 23, but his engine was timed out. So I put an engine in that and then I sold it for a very, very good price. I think I sold it for 42 or 44. So I turned around and bought the Mooney. So I was in good shape. Yeah.
Okay. Let's explore that real quick. So we're going to kind of go off on a side tangent over there on the Mooney, because I think that's pretty interesting, you know, like plane ownership and like things like that. Obviously, yeah, first-hand experience. You know, you've owned the Mooney for years now, right? So let's say just over the years, what's the cost of ownership, I guess, is my question. Do you have a tie-down or a hangar or something like that out there?
And I've only had the hangar for a little over a year. I was on a tie-down for years.
Okay.
You know, you as a financial planner would say, you have no business owning an airplane. But when you want something that bad, you figure it out. You figure out a way. So what do I budget for the airplane? You know, since I don't have a partner in it, it's
all you, right?
You know, and I'm not one that saved up for the engine overhauls and all that kind of stuff. I figure, well, I got two houses. I can figure out how to do that when the time comes.
Just for
it's one of those things where you always just kind of, no, I just want to go have fun now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, if you're passionate about something, you know, might not be the best.
This is all the things I tell my clients not to do.
I know, saving, you know, budgeting, all that stuff.
I'm here to tell you, you can still do it. But yeah. I usually figure my annuals are about $2,500. The hangers, $460. You know, and then you do like three or four oil changes a year, maybe, depending on how much you fly. And that's a couple $100 each time. And then you kind of have to just whatever comes up during the year that might have to be fixed. So I don't really have a budget for that. That's always a surprise. So I just let it happen.
Has anything major come up like over the years, or is it pretty like reliable?
I do budget at least one full tank of gas a month.
There you go. Well, at least you got something.
At least 6 hours of flying time.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, good. Now, like with the Mooney, I mean, is it a pretty reliable plane? Like, have you had to like replace a whole bunch of stuff?
Will be reliable as long as you keep up with the maintenance. Airplanes are pretty basic. They haven't changed materially over the last 40 years. So the engine, fuel pump, the power plants are pretty basic and standard, and they are workhorses. And Lycoming's a good engine, so I'm happy.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Breaks,
but it's not, you know, you somehow, you just know because of the timing between having those things fixed. when they're due.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So thank you for that. So anyways, let's get back on topic. So Mooney, so you got the Mooney, you started flying the Mooney, and then what happened from there?
Well, then I decided I needed 25 hours in the Mooney to get my insurance, and I didn't have any retractable time. So that was going to be, that was why my insurance was requiring that. So I thought, well, why, I might as well go get a rating. So I went and got my commercial, and I did that in the Mooney. So I was, and that was a fun rating to get. It was fun because you get used to your airplane. You get to fly by numbers, learn a lot about your airplane. So that's what I did. And I got my commercial in the Mooney, and yeah. So then I was on my way. I haven't gotten a rating since. I've gotten a tailwheel endorsement since then, but okay. I've been happy flying it. So
yeah. Okay. That's good. That's good. Okay. So then, you know, you've been flying the Mooney, and let's see, at the same time, let's see, what were you? So you know, just kind of go through like your career. So after TRW, what did you do after that?
Yeah, I left TRW thinking I might retire. And then I thought, then that didn't really work out. So I went back to work, and I worked at the airport at a company that takes people up to see what it's like to be a fighter pilot. It's called Air Combat USA. I believe they're okay. Still operating out of Orange County. They left Fullerton, and there are some changes because the owner that I worked for passed away. So okay. I don't really know what's going on with that company now, but I worked there for 24 years and had a blast. I mean, it was really fun. You had people with smiles on their faces all the time. I got to fly cross country a few times as part of the job. Fun. Yeah, it was a fun job.
Let's see. So you guys were the company, took people up, and you guys like dogfights and...
They would be simulated dogfights. I mean, the only thing really simulated were the bullets. I mean, everything else was you flew the airplane, that you were coached by your instructor was kind of keeping you out of trouble.
Yeah.
But really, the airplanes were fully aerobatic. They were CI Marchettis. They can handle just about anything. They're just beautiful airplanes to fly. They were all equipped with electronic tracking, so you could tell when you lock onto your target. Then you had video playing the whole time you were flying. I mean, it was quite an experience. It was fun. Like I said, it was fun to watch. And we used to do a lot of corporate events, and we flew out of 25 or 30 cities around the country. So a lot of my job was scheduling the airports and the locations and who was going to host us when we were in a given city.
That's interesting. That's interesting. So let's say someone goes in, like, do they require like a pilot's license, or just anyone can go in, you know, sit in with an instructor and really?
Yeah, this was a fantasy camp for just people who thought, you know, they should have been, you know, did have some pilots, but most of them were non-pilots that would fly with us.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. That's really interesting. So then after that, where'd you go after Air Combat?
Oh, when I left Air Combat, I got hired at Pac-Man. It was a gentleman that I'd seen at the airport a number of times. I knew him, but not real well. But anyway, and he asked if I was really interested in retiring. And he said, well, why don't you come down and talk to me and we'll see if there's a fit. Because I'd been in the business world. I'd been around aviation and all those things. They're definitely an aviation-focused company. So I did. And I just love this place. This is the nicest, most interesting group of people I've ever worked with. Honestly, they are passionate about what they do. And we do all kinds of models, physical, digital, and interactive modeling for marketing and branding tools. So our stuff ends up at trade shows around the world. Our stuff ends up at airlines all over the world. It's just really a cool place to be.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's really interesting. So you guys, make like mock-up, like just models, just basically whatever the manufacturers want or whatever the airlines want. Like, hey, I don't know, we want not like life size, but we want this huge, like full scale.
Don't say that.
Oh, like life size?
We built the TX, which was Boeing's entry into the Air Force's. They had a contest with all the aerospace manufacturers to build the next Air Force trainer. And Boeing had their entry, and it was the TX. We built a full-scale TX. It's a 40-foot long airplane. And we built it, we rolled it out, and we shipped it to their very first trade show somewhere in Washington, D.C. And then it's been around the world. This airplane has been all over. And they won the contract. We always say that they won it because of us, but but they won the contract. And we've made others. They just redid the paint scheme on it with a red tail for Tuskegee Airmen.
Yeah.
They've introduced now the red tail version of it, Red Hawk, they call it. And it's beautiful, just stunning. And that just went two or three shows, that model. That one's not a full-scale model, though. But we're building another one that's 140-foot wingspan. So, I mean, we do all kinds of stuff. And we'll do desktop models. There'll be stuff that ends up on your executives' desks. And when they deliver an airplane for Boeing, they want to make sure they have an airplane that's produced by Pac-Man.
Oh, really?
Because we really take our time, and they're beautiful pieces of art, actually, when we're done.
Yeah. How long has this business been around?
Since 1946.
Is it family-owned, I think, or not family-owned?
Started as two Douglas guys were making models, and then they started the business separate from Douglas.
Okay.
And continued, and then Fred bought the company in, Fred Aulin, who was the owner, he bought the company in the 60s, I believe. I better not quote that, since I'm not really sure exactly when he bought it, but he's owned it for a long time, and he's really built it up into doing all kinds of special projects. I mean, at that point, we were basically models, cutaways, those kinds of things. Now we do that. We do digital animation, like CGI, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, it's expensive to launch airplanes, so lots of people like to use CGI to replace flying airplanes around to get good footage.
Yeah. Interesting. That's really interesting.
We can make it look like it's flying. We can make it look really, really photorealistic. We say that all the time, but it's true.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So you work kind of, you know, you're not a pilot, but you do work in the aviation industry. You've done the air combat thing for quite a while. You've been through Pac-Man for a little while. So one thing I'd like to ask, or one thing I'd like to get into, is just kind of recessions. I ask pilots all the time. It's like, okay, well, how did the recession of, let's say, back in the early 2000s and 2008. Obviously, it hits the aviation industry pretty hard as far as airlines are concerned. Yeah, we all know that. There's furloughs, there's mergers and acquisitions and bankruptcies and all that kind of stuff. Now, kind of in your shoes, going from your experience outside of the airline world, but still kind of connected to the airline world, I mean, how those recessions affect you guys?
Yeah, well, I can tell you that 2001 resulted in about 40% refunds like the next day for us. We took money on account and we flew them off, paid for it ahead of time, and then you booked it. And then that confirmed your, like you would go to on an airline trip, right? But we had about a 40% refund rate the next day. But, you know, it only lasted for a few months and it trickled back up again. And you know what?
Really?
This country kind of came together and said, no, we're not taking this. We're going to keep going. And believe it or not, yeah, there were more restrictions and more things that came into play that we had to work around. But we got through 2001 okay. 2008 was a different story. That one was a lot harder because I think corporate-wise, it affected everyone. And so there was not a lot of extra money to use for events and things and expensive gifts. And, you know, people were pulling back in a lot of ways. I mean, all of us saw our nest eggs shrink that year. So disposable income was, there just wasn't any. So that one lasted a lot longer. That one lasted probably about 2 years. We started to pull out of that probably in the 2010, 11, somewhere in there. And then we really pulled out and things were going back to normal.
Okay, interesting. Interesting.
I don't know about Pac-Man because I wasn't there at that time, but I'm guessing that they probably experienced very similar things.
Yeah. Now, like with air combat, I mean, obviously you're relying on, I don't know what you call it, like tourism or just kind of, yeah, you know, people coming in.
Definitely disposable income. I mean, it's a luxury. It's something that someone does for fun. So that's one of the first things to go.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. That's interesting. Okay. And then let's see, Pac-Man. So you guys just basically work with everyone in the aviation industry, huh? So like just Boeing, Airbus, like.
We're very fortunate. Yeah. I mean, we have quite a reputation for producing a really good product. And so when it's important to be on a trade show floor, they want something that's going to respect their brand really well. And we tool the models that we produce so that they're accurate within the CAD that we're provided. So it's not like somebody's carving it in some out of wood or something. These are really accurately produced. So that's very important to our manufacturers for sure. Liveries are very important to our airlines and that they, you know, that everything is respected perfectly. And we do.
And they're accurate.
Really
and,
okay. Wonderful graphics team that put it all together and apply it to the airplane meticulously. So when you're all done, you really do have a piece of art. So.
Yeah, that's interesting. They're like moving parts and everything. Like I'm just curious, like do the flaps move and like.
These are not toys in any way. They're used as display pieces. But
yeah, like marketing pieces.
We did do the Osprey and the engines articulate and the prop spin. So that's about as close as we can. We do have other things that we've done where there's actually moving parts on it. I mean, sometimes you're doing an exhibit model and things are happening on the model. So like we did one recently for UTC, they did a hybrid electric motor that's going to go, that they wanted to show on a turboprop, and it showed how the electric power gets to the engines, and it had all these things travel through the airplane and stuff. Yeah, that was at Paris Air Show.
Okay, interesting. Interesting. So you do a few things, or you did and still do a few things outside of work as well. One thing that you did was you were part of the, are you still part of the 99s?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you did a stint there for a little while as the chairwoman of the 99s. So just kind of talk us through it. And what was that experience like?
Yeah, I was chairman for 7 years.
Chairwoman, sorry.
Chairwoman. It was a fun time. That was probably around the 2008 timeframe, and things were tight, and there weren't a lot of pilot starts. And we got to be a very small chapter for a period of time, and we almost thought we weren't going to be able to keep a chapter going. And then things started to loosen up. We started to really go out and campaign, and we stopped doing things like serious fundraising, which sometimes isn't always all that much fun to do. You know, we wanted to make it so that we were going places and doing things that people would want to join the chapter and go do. And so we planned a lot of fly-ins and stuff, and just started taking people places, getting them enthusiastic about flying. And we have got probably 4 or 5 people that have gotten their license through knowing us. That maybe
really?
We're just on the edge or on the fence, you know? And we have really grown from, we got down to about 10 people, and now we're up at 35. So that's a success story. And I'm not saying it was me. I'm just saying that it was the times, and it just goes to show that when you keep things active, as long as an organization continues to do things, then people will want to be part of it. But if it stagnates, no one wants to be involved. The 99 is really active right now. And we have a lot of new people that are taking over the reins, which is nice.
Yeah. When did you join the 99s originally?
You know, right after I got my license. I got my license in August of 1990. And I waited till I was done because I was already at the airport almost every night. I couldn't find room for anything else. Then when I got my license, I immediately joined. And I have been a member ever since. So August of 1990.
August 9th. And I'm assuming that's something that you would highly recommend.
I do. I mean, it's women pilots, and it's a great mentoring. I mean, when I started, we were operating in kind of a man's world, so to speak. I mean, it wasn't bad, but I'm just saying that sometimes it's just nice to be around other women pilots so you can kind of relax a little bit and talk about the things that women don't always grow up with, the same training and kinds of things. You know, we don't learn engines like men do. You know, and when you get into flying, you've got to start learning some of that stuff. You got to know how the fuel system works. You got to learn all that stuff. So we would bring in mechanics to teach us different things that probably a guy who took a car to car when he was growing up doesn't need to know, you know.
So definitely.
Trying to apply our meetings to something that was useful to women pilots. So
yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. So what was that progression like then? Yeah, let's say you're a new member, or actually let's talk about the 99s in general for those people that don't know. Obviously, it's a pretty huge organization now, pretty big.
Yeah, there's about 7,000 members worldwide. It was started in 1929 by Amelia Earhart. And they had just run the Powder Puff Derby, or the first women's air race, to Cleveland, Ohio. And they all had so much fun, they decided, I think we need to start an organization. So they sent out invitations to all the licensed women pilots at the time, and 99 responded. And that's how they got their name.
Okay.
It's got a great history, and it's evolved beautifully into what it is today. 7,000 members worldwide. We just had our very first section meeting in China, and I got to go to that.
Days
in China, and we had a wonderful time. And the gal that started the China section, her name is Ida Zhang, she learned to fly in Fullerton, or she joined the Fullerton chapter, and she was one of those ones that we mentored. We really brought her into our fold, and she had a little bit of language barrier and stuff and all those things to get around, and we just nurtured her. And honest to God, she has been such a wonderful shining light. And now she's back in China trying to open up general aviation in this country that is amazing, absolutely amazing. It has all the capabilities, but it just, I don't know, it needs to be focused differently, I guess.
I know nothing about aviation in China. You know, I mean, does general aviation exist in China?
At a very limited level. I mean, they have very few general aviation airports to begin with, and those that they do, airplanes are only allowed to fly like 5 kilometers from an airport. So it's like 5 miles or something.
Really? That's how you can, so there's like
so
a
all
five
you can do is pattern work. Everything is like a great big restricted area.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. Okay. So you can't.
They get special permissions occasionally to do different things, but it's all based on the government controls it all. And so until they can open that up a little bit, they're having a pilot shortage too, and they're trying to address it in their own ways. So they're open to suggestions, I think, now, but it's going to be a long time. They don't have the infrastructure, so it's going to be a long time coming. Absolutely fascinating. We actually spoke at a school that was an aviation and STEM-focused school, and we gave them a presentation on what it's like to fly in the U.S., and of course, everything has to be translated, so probably lost a little bit in the translation, but you get this feeling that it's universal. The dream of flying is absolutely universal.
Yeah, well, I think every kid, like, you know, just me included, you know, we always look up at the
Who
sky.
Who doesn't
and,
look up?
I know, I think it was, who was it? It's Derek Vento. He runs the Traffic Pattern podcast, and he's actually a friend of mine. And I was listening to one of his episodes, and it's just, and he was talking about this. He had a term for it, but I forget what it is. But basically, you're outside, you hear an engine, you hear an airplane, and you always look up. Whether it's cloudy or not, it could be like overcast, like right over your head, and you still look up.
I live under the final approach for Fullerton. So I see every airplane that goes over, and I have a little deck out here that I can sit at. And
nice,
I try
okay.
to identify what airplane it is without
from the sound?
Looking. Just by the sound, yeah. Piper's easy. They have a little
Yeah. that's pretty cool. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Now, let's see. So you talked about airlines and like stuff like that a little bit, like women, you know, what opportunities for women back in the time when you're training with your license and stuff like that. Did you ever think about going into the airlines?
You know, I did, but I started kind of late to begin with, and they weren't really hiring much when I started. I've aged out now, so that's out of the question. But I sometimes think about some of these little startups that are, you know, where they don't have the age limit, you know, maybe going out and getting myself type-rated in like a caravan or something that I can maybe learn something else and go do something different.
Yeah.
And fly. And maybe if I finally get to the point where I'm really ready to retire, and then I would do that as the next level, next job. Or maybe even a flight instructor. I never did that before. I'm thinking, I don't know that I have the nerve to let somebody get in an airplane and go fly it. Somebody had that nerve to let me go, because I'm telling you, once you go, that moment is the aha moment.
Yeah, I think about that too. And it's like, I'm 38 as well. And I'm just, you know, I'm starting my flight training.
You're my age. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. You know,
you could join the airlines because they're hiring like crazy.
Yeah, most likely. Yeah, I've thought about that. I'm like, it would be kind of cool to fly jets. Yeah, it would be a pretty cool opportunity. And yeah, and like you said, there's all sorts of different outfits too. All sorts of commercial outfits. And I think the goal is to try to get up in the air without actually having to pay for it.
Yeah. See, that's the equation I never got.
You know, it's like, I don't need, you know,
that's like, I am.
Yeah, it's like, we're not going to rely on the income, but you know, it's like, if we can kind of, you know, fly for fun, get up in the air, not have to pay rental fees or gas or insurance or all that kind of stuff, I think that would be an awesome opportunity. Yeah, definitely. Now, through the years, like just through your work with the 99s and things like that, you know, have you seen an increase in women wanting to be airline pilots, or just women wanting to be pilots in general?
Yeah, we give away scholarships, and we've seen an influx of scholarships given away for women to get their advanced rating so they're ready for the airlines. You know, they're all in time building mode right now, but we probably have four in our chapter that are doing that. We had one that went to the Air Force Reserves, and she's flying the C-130 right now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we've got two or three that are destined for the airlines, definitely. One's flying for the MedFly people. And she's building time, getting herself positioned. She's a flight attendant for Delta, and she eventually will go for the airlines.
Okay, nice.
Once she has the hours in.
Yeah, definitely. That's awesome. That's awesome. Now, let's see. So what's your current role then, currently? So you're the chairwoman of the 99s. And
I'm trying not to have any real role. I just want to be there and just kind of keep. Every time they say we're going to go fly somewhere, how many passengers can you take? I say three, and we're gone. I'm in. You know, I get involved in lots of different ways. I'm involved in one scholarship that we established for the man that ran air combat for many, many years was Michael E. Blackstone. And when he passed away, you know, we started a scholarship in his name. So we handle that. And then I handle that one. And it's for an aerobatic scholarship. So unusual attitude training, because that's what he really loved. So we wanted to make sure that it was something that he would have been excited about.
Yeah, definitely. What type of scholarships do the 99s offer or do they have?
Well, the Amelia Earhart Scholarship Fund is quite large and they give away all kinds of, you go and you figure out what you want to try to do, if it's ATP or what it is, or if it's type reading or whether it's ATC or whatever, and you figure out what the training is going to cost and you submit your bills and then you submit your essay on why you think you should receive this and all the other details that they require. And if you win it, you could get $5,000 towards some sort of a rating or otherwise, or even more. We even have now for pilots just getting started, we have what we call Fly Now scholarships. And they're smaller amounts, but they can go on account of flight school and really offset some of those costs at the, because I think they were always a little bit leery about doing too much at the private level because they weren't sure if people would actually do the whole thing. But they've worked it out so that you finish your rating and then they would reimburse you. I think it's $3,000 or something for Fly Now.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, that's really nice. That's really nice. So now, let's see, you're also part of board of directors, right, on the Aero Club of Southern California?
That's the Aero Club, and they do scholarship too, and they're not specifically pilots. Their scholarships are towards engineering and different things that go into fields in aerospace. So we gave away 10, I think it was, 5 high school and 5 college. And the college ones were $5,000 each. And I don't know if I'm doing that right. Anyway, we gave away about $35,000 worth of scholarships this year.
Okay, wow.
I think it was 5 and 3, so.
5 and 3, okay. Are they all for like high school aged?
High school age and college bound kids.
College bound kids.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what is the Aero Club of Southern California? Like, what do you guys do? Like, what's the mission?
You know, our mission is really to celebrate the legacy of famous aviators, really. We own the Spruce Goose. The organization owned the Spruce Goose. They sold it about, I don't know, 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, to Evergreen up in McMinnville. So that Spruce Goose is now in a museum up in McMinnville, Oregon. And we took payments for all those years and it helped build up our scholarship fund. But as an organization, they do one big fundraiser a year. It is the Howard Hughes Memorial Award, and that gets awarded to somebody who has really made a difference in aviation or aerospace or some other. You know, like we gave it to Marilyn Houston 1 year. She was amazing. We gave it to Jeb Bush, from the Northrop Grumman CEO. We gave it to Boeing CEO 1 year. We gave it to Buzz Aldrin last year. He didn't actually come, which was kind of disappointing, but we've moved on. This year, we're giving it to Captain Chesley Sullenberger. And so we're very excited about having him there. I've met him before and he is just a doll, just fun, interesting, passionate about aviation safety. So he will be a wonderful recipient.
Yeah, I think I've read his book. I forget the name of it. Yeah, I think The Miracle on Hudson or something like that. But I think he has an aviation safety like consulting business, right?
He does. Yeah. Because I'm sure he's aged out of flying anyway. But yeah, absolutely. He's a great guy. And he was there with Jeff Skiles and they were so funny. They were absolutely just a joy to listen to. Yeah.
Nice. And then LIGA was the other thing. So just tell us a little bit about that. I think that's really interesting. You use your Mooney for those purposes as well, right?
I do. And then sometimes I do the schedule the pilots that go down there.
So tell us what LIGA is.
You know, I'm what they call the pilot coordinator, a dear friend who is a 99, been in my chapter for years and years, and she's just been best friends for probably 30 years since I started. Her name is Pat Savage, and she has been the pilot coordinator for probably 20 years now with LIGA. And so what she was always saying, you need to start going, you know, you'll like this, you know, it's great flying, and I kept thinking, you know, I really need to do something to give back, enjoy this wonderful privilege of flying. Actually, it helps because you're actually reimbursed for quite a bit of the cost going down there. But you're still doing something. You're giving back. You're helping an organization. And then, I mean, these people in Mexico have nothing. I mean, we think about poverty here. It's nothing. It doesn't compare to what we see down there. And the diseases and the issues and problems and, you know, medical things that have to happen. So we take doctors and nurses down to two clinics. In a large month, we will take 120 medical personnel down to Mexico and probably 27 airplanes.
27. So
I've
like
seen
today.
27 airplanes go down there. Yeah. All parked along the runway at El Fuerte. They look like little soldiers. It's just marvelous. And we'll go to work. I mean, for me, I'm a lowly pilot, so I'll go clean, scrub toilets or whatever they need me to do. Sometimes I count in pills in the pharmacy, whatever they need me to do. But the main thing is to get the medical people down there safely.
And that's one flight down there usually, or is it multiple trips to get everyone, all the doctors down there and the medical personnel?
You get your passenger list and you go. And typically we stop in Ciudad Obregón. Some people have different airports they like to stop at to clear customs because there's no customs in El Fuerte. And then we go on to El Fuerte. So for me, if I go to Obregón, it's 4 hours to Obregón and then it's another 40 minutes to El Fuerte. So it's about a 5 hour flight. And then we're there from Friday till Sunday, the first weekend of every month.
Okay. So this is every month then?
Well, actually they're down during the summer. They go in June. They do not go in July, August, or September. They start again in October, but they go all winter long.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They'll take an entire eye team down there out of Davis, and they will do 80 cataract surgeries in a weekend, like an assembly line. And these are people that are blind. When they get to us, they basically can't see at all.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's really amazing.
Yeah. I mean, Pat tells a story of one man coming in with his nephew or grandson on a donkey. And he comes in and they restore his sight. Next morning, they packed him a lunch and he was off on his donkey to go back home. You know, it's just amazing, amazing stuff. There's so many stories.
Well, that's really cool. So is this something that you do like every single month or like a few, like once every other month or something?
I've gone about 17 times. I have not gone this year, so I need to get back into it. But I've been the pilot coordinator a couple times this year. So when Pat can have time off and she goes to Colorado and, you know, she needs time off. It's like herding cats, you know, sometimes.
Yeah, that's funny. That's funny. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, it's like I'd love like the use of the airplane just for charitable purposes and just to help out and give back and all that stuff.
Really a great group of people. Well, Jay Bruce is one of them. He flies down there occasionally. And, you know, I was always one that go maybe two or three times a year, but some of the people go every single month. I mean, like 50 missions down there. I have 17. I'm just novice. But when I retire, I will. Someday I will. I don't know when I will.
Yeah, like once again, I have no clue what the flying is like in Mexico. So is it pretty easy?
Yeah.
So what is it like to just kind of cross the border, go through customs, like fly in Mexico? Is it about the same as up here or is it a good bit different?
Yeah, you fly on an international flight plan. It's the same as here. Now they have radar down there. So, you know, you're in radar coverage. You're talking to controllers just like you would here. The paperwork is a little more complicated than when we fly around here. We can fly places here and we don't even have to do a flight paper flight plan. But down there, you produce paper flight plans, you hand them to them and they stamp everything. If it's not right, they redo it. But it's fun, you know. I mean, they're very good to us. There's some fees involved with different things. But yeah, as long as you got all your documents in a row, you're good.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Let's see. So just kind of looking back, with everything, just with Pac-Man, you know, with your career, you know, all that kind of stuff. Well, not looking back, but let's say looking forward. So what's next for you? What's next for the company? What's next for you? You know,
put my best efforts into making Pac-Man successful, which it is. It's doing well. We're great. Lots of stuff coming in and going out. I just love to see us show up at all these fancy places, these wonderful places like Paris Air Show and Singapore and Qatar and all these places around the world.
Do you guys attend all the different, like all the big air shows out there?
Sometimes if we have something that we need to provide support, if the model has been there before and they put it together before, then we don't necessarily need to be there. But if for the first time for a model, we saw lots of times we'll go and support that. But anyway, yeah, we had a wonderful trip to Oshkosh, Wisconsin for EAA this year. We actually sponsored the D-Day doll, which is World War II C-53 that went to Normandy. And on the way back, we sponsored it to make a detour and stop in Oshkosh.
Oh, so wow. Nice. That okay.
Fun. That's pretty cool. We invited all our customers that are at the show because, I mean, we'll have Embraer and we'll have Textron. We'll have friends at Cirrus and Airbus and Boeing there. So we'll invite them all out to come and see the airplane and tour it and look inside of it and stuff. So that was fun. That was really a fun thing to do this year. And I always go to Oshkosh anyway. I've been the last.
Have you gone every? Okay. Yeah. How is Oshkosh? I've actually never been.
Oh, yes. You must go.
I mean, I've heard it's, you know, obviously amazing. And there's just so many events and things to do and just amazing people out there.
Yeah. It's definitely an immersion into aviation. And everywhere you go, you sit down at lunch or wherever else, you're talking to people from all over the world that are just all there for one main focus. And they always just have the most amazing displays. And it's fun to see what's coming out and go to all the different companies like Garmin. And I just love Garmin and ForeFlight and Boeing and all the, and just see what they're coming out with. That's a great place to showcase new products and new things.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And then camp under your wing. And then camp under your wing. Go back to your tent. I don't camp anywhere in my life. Anywhere. And I camp in Oshkosh. North.
Nice. Park. I heard it's usually like pretty rainy out there, can like be, during yeah. those times. Or yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes they call it sloshkosh.
Nice. Nice. It just adds to the fun, right?
Yeah. It's always an adventure, no matter what. You just count on it.
Nice. So what's next for you then?
Well, let's see. This year, I want to go back to Oshkosh. I'm going to put an engine in the airplane this year. So okay. I think next year, I want to go back to Alaska. I went to Alaska in 2000, and I'd like to go back up there again.
Okay. Fly up there?
Yeah.
In the Mooney? Yeah.
That was a marvelous trip. One of the best trips I ever took.
Where did you go up in Alaska?
Well, we flew up the Trench, which is up through, follow the Fraser River, Prince George, up to an area called Watson Lake, and then over to Whitehorse. That's all British Columbia and Yukon territories. And then we went into Alaska over Northway and then up to Fairbanks. So we spent a few days in Fairbanks, and then we went over to and landed in a place called Healy River and went to Denali and went through the park, spent several days there, and then came on down to went to Homer and spent a few days there. And we went over to a little area called King Salmon, which is out on the peninsula, and that, you know, you can only get there by airplane, so that was kind of exciting. That was a fun trip all the way around. You know, we flew in weather, you wouldn't even go to the airport if you were home. If you can stay under it, you've got 50-mile visibility. But if you can't stay under it, sometimes you're 400 or 500 feet. You know, there were times when we'd be flying from one place to another, and we'd say, "Yeah, let's turn around. We're not going to be able to get through." And somebody would go through going the other way at 500 feet below us, and we're saying, "Ah, maybe we can." And everybody talks on frequencies. They're always communicating and they're always saying, "Yeah, you can get to Whitehorse, no worries. Yeah, you'll make it. Okay.
It'll be fine."
Yeah, you'll be fine. The famous word was, "It's doable." Okay. Hey, it's doable. Let's go. As long as you don't rule out all your options, like you always make sure you've got a backup plan. You know, you got a way to turn around, go back, you can make your previous airport, you're fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Nice. Well, as we wrap up over here, you know, I'm going to go through just, you know, some fun questions. Let's see, hobby. Let's see, hobbies outside of work.
Oh my gosh.
I said outside of work, but yeah, obviously.
Yeah, no,
work.
I know. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, outside of flying.
Flying is the biggest one.
Yeah. But let's say outside of flying.
Gosh, what else do I do? My family's important.
Yeah. Well, I mean, flying's a pretty big hobby, so yeah. I mean, I'm assuming like once you retire, everything.
I like yoga. Okay, wait. Okay, there are other things. I like yoga. I like to cycle. I do bike trips sometimes down to the beach. I like to travel even commercially. I mean, I'm not opposed to traveling commercially.
Like, oh God, jeez, have to fly commercially.
I will go to TSA once in a while.
Well, let's say if you have to go to the East Coast, let's say, you know, for like a business trip or just for a trip, personal trip or whatever, would you actually take the Mooney out there or would you actually fly commercially?
I've been to Ohio 3 times, I think, and all over the U.S. a couple times. Oshkosh, 12 times, something like that. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah. Well, sure. Hey, I'll go. I will always volunteer.
There you go.
I will. So favorite aircraft. So out of, you know, just all the aircraft out there, commercial aircraft, whatever, you know, GA aircraft, what is your actual favorite aircraft besides your Mooney?
Oh my goodness. What would be, you can't say, yeah, I mean, I love the airplanes that you still really fly. Like, I think the biggest airplane I would be excited about would be like a Pilatus or a Kodiak or something like that. I mean, a workhorse kind of an airplane. I'd love to own an airplane that's a tail dragger at some point in my life and go back into some of these really backcountry strips. I mean, that's always been a fantasy, you know, or some one of those things that I dream about or think about. There's one an airplane called a Sportsman that's made up in Oregon, and I think about that one. I've talked to them at Oshkosh, I don't know how many times. That's more than one, I know. I don't know what to tell you. Let's see. Yeah. I love the F-35. I'll probably never fly one.
I know. I think most of us out there will definitely never fly one in our lifetimes, that's for sure. But it would be pretty amazing, though.
I met Marilyn Houston, and she never offered. I don't know. What is it?
Well, I'm sure you. I'm sure you guys have probably made scale models of it.
We make a beautiful F-35.
Yeah, I guess that's as close as you'll ever get to one.
So I guess I can't complain.
Yeah, it is a beautiful airplane, though. I'd love like the F-35s, F-30, or F-22s. Like those two, like are just like they're amazing.
That was the other one that the pilots really love. That one. That's being kind of. I don't know. Is that still flying? They're flying, yeah. Them, but I don't know that they're producing them anymore. I don't know.
Yeah. What's your least favorite aircraft and why?
Oh, gosh. Oh, man. What do I have? You know, anything that flies is pretty good.
Yeah. Is there one aircraft that you've flown in the past where you're like, oh, man, like this thing is horrible? Without, you know, pissing off any manufacturers.
I don't know. I was never crazy about this Skymaster push-pull, the Cessna. I actually flew in one once years ago. I was not crazy about that airplane, but I can't say anything horrible about it. I just was never crazy about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much anything that flies is, you know, it's a good thing.
Happy.
Yeah. Now what's interesting, like, or just funny or interesting or scary, whatever you want to share, like aviation story that you have for us?
Oh gosh. Do I have any? Well, I have lots of stories, actually. I have lots of stories, but everything always works out so far. I just always measure all the risks every time I do something, and I try not to get myself in situations.
Oh, yeah.
There have been moments where I thought, yeah, I wish I was down there. This was many, many, many years ago, and I was on a trip to Ohio with my sister and our two daughters, and I was trying to get to Ohio, which destination looked fine, but there was some weather in between. And I remember I stopped in St. Louis and I checked weather. This is way back before we had all the weather information on board that we have today. I would probably have just stayed in St. Louis if I'd known that. But yeah. I launched once and tried to go up the Ohio River, and that was not working out because the visibility went down south. So I turned around, went back to St. Louis, checked again. Then I climbed up and went on top, and I kept realizing that the clouds kept growing and growing. IFR rated, but it wasn't the kind of weather that you wanted to file in. There were thunderstorms and stuff. Like Indianapolis was being hammered and none of the controllers wanted to talk to me. So I ended up on some frequency where you got to talk on one and then you got to listen on another. And it's like this, you know, and I'm trying to find somebody to say my destination is still decent, or should I just get out of Dodge and go back to St. Louis and just call it a wrap? It was one of those kind of moments where you think, God, maybe I shouldn't have gone.
Yeah.
I did get somebody and he said, oh yeah, you'll break out right around Dayton and it'll be broken right around Dayton or scattered right around Dayton and then you'll be fine to get to Cleveland. So I went on, but I mean, for those moments, especially when you have three people in the airplane that are non-pilots, nobody to compare notes with, and you're just trying to make sure you do the right thing. And I remember thinking that was probably one of my more aha moments.
Yeah.
You've got all this weather data on board and we didn't have any of that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can make better, much more educated decisions on the ground too. And, you know, I guess back then you had to just kind of roll with the punches.
You know how quickly, you know, things can change when you take off. After you've taken off, things can deteriorate. And that's what happens, especially in the Midwest. When things start to build up, they build up fast. And then they, before you know it, you're at 12,000 feet and you're, you know. It worked out fine.
So now, you know, you've gone through years and years of just plane ownership. You've worked, you know, multiple careers, successful career. Now, someone just came up to you and said, Denise, what is your best financial advice that you can give me? What would you say? Besides save for, you know.
When the lottery. No, I don't know. You know, if you are willing to sacrifice other things, you know, I mean, I'm going to put an engine in my airplane. I could have a Tesla.
How much does that cost?
I want my airplane and I want it flying. Just giving me way, way more joy than I think a Tesla would. So I have to make trade-offs all the time because I'm not, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It is all about just sacrificing and just kind of making, you know, you have your passion, right?
And I don't know if you really think of it as a sacrifice because that's really not important to me. To me, a car is what gets you to the airport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And flying is the real.
To get me to the airport.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. As long as you're making, you know, smart decisions to kind of support the things that you're passionate about and just kind of making everything work. I mean, I think that's probably the most important thing out there.
I've made it this long without having a partner in the airplane. And I keep thinking, you know, that's always an option if I get to the point where I don't think I should be spending that kind of money.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, Denise, thank you for joining me on the Level Playing Field podcast. It was awesome. You have such a wide array of just experiences across through the volunteer work, you know, through the different organizations, through Air Combat, Pac-Man, like all that kind of stuff. It was just really interesting just to hear your story and experiences and just your passion.
Not that much, but you know. No, I appreciate your interest and having me on the show. And thank you. You've been great to work with. And
yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Keep up the good work. Get out there and get flying.
Yeah, thank you. I will. I definitely will.
All right.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Level Playing Field podcast. Make sure to visit our website, thelevelplainfield.com, where you can subscribe to the show so you'll never miss a single episode. If you found value in this episode, please rate us on iTunes or simply tell a friend about us. Join us again next week for a chance to propel your knowledge to new heights.